Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. With fears growing of financial collapse in Greece and a chaotic exit from the Eurozone, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras expressed confidence a deal will be reached that will keep his country in the euro currency union. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more on the story as the Eurozone prepares for a possible future without Athens.
Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras spoke before a rowdy European Parliament just hours after the end of an inconclusive summit in Brussels, and just hours before a Thursday deadline for Greece to deliver a credible reform plan to fellow Eurozone members.
Είναι πρόταση που περιλαμβάνει αξιόπιστες μεταρρυθμίσεις.
Mr. Tsipras received a mix of boos and cheers as he said Greece will continue with reforms and deliver the proposals Greek creditors want in return for securing new bailout funds. But he said Greeks also need a sign there is light at the end of a difficult tunnel, hope of an exit to the crisis. The Prime Minister spoke amid growing warnings that time is running out for Greece. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Russia has vetoed a draft UN resolution condemning the 1995 massacre at Srebrenica during the Bosnian War as an act of genocide. The UN Security Council vote was 10-1. Four Security Council members, Angola, China, Nigeria, and Venezuela, abstained. British Ambassador Peter Wilson says his country was outraged by Russia's veto. Russia's actions tarnishes the memory of all those who died in Srebrenica genocide, Wilson said. Russia will have to justify its behavior to the families of over 8,000 people murdered in the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II. This is VOA News. The New York Stock Exchange halted all trading midway through its Wednesday session. Exchange officials said a technical issue forced the suspension of trading. Before trading was stopped at 11:30 a.m. in New York, key U.S. indexes were down a bit more than 1%. Analysts said worries about China's slowing economic growth and stock market troubles worried some investors. In Europe, however, where talks continued on Greece's debt problems, markets traded higher. Apart from the main New York exchange, share trading continued on other exchanges. The Wall Street Journal reported that the S&P 500 and other stock indexes were little changed from where they were before the New York Stock Exchange trading stopped. Chinese stocks, meanwhile, continued to tumble Wednesday, prompting Beijing to warn of a panic sentiment by investors and unveil a series of desperate new measures to stop the three-week slide. The benchmark Shanghai Composite Index closed down nearly 6%, while the Shenzhen Composite Index slid 2.5%, continuing a crash that has wiped out $3.2 trillion of market value since mid-June. Trying to shield themselves from the sell-off, hundreds more Chinese companies filed for trading suspensions Wednesday. In total, over 1,300 mainland companies, that's 40% of the market, have halted trading. Iran and major international powers continue nuclear negotiations in Vienna on Wednesday after blowing through a second self-imposed deadline.
Well, I'm not going to go into the individual issues, but as you know, there are a range of issues that where there are political discussions that need to be had, and there will need to be some trade-offs, there will need to be some difficult decisions made on both sides if we're going to get this done. But I think there is a clear will on both sides now to complete this agreement and to keep at it until we get there.
Negotiators have now given themselves until Friday to come up with a comprehensive deal. Pope Francis continues his tour of South America in Bolivia Wednesday after urging the faithful to open their arms to the poor and preserve the environment for future generations during a pair of speeches in Ecuador. The pontiff told a group of business leaders and indigenous tribes in the capital city of Quito that the goods of the earth are meant for everyone, and however much someone may parade his property, it has a social mortgage. His remarks on the environment were the first since he released his encyclical last month, calling on world leaders to take immediate action to halt climate change, including ending the Earth's reliance on fossil fuels. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. The former vice president said he is still willing to engage in ongoing peace talks to resolve the conflict.
That's VOA's Lenny Ruvaga reporting. Details next.
Also, an Eritrean ambassador says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. VOA's Lenny Ruvaga reports the former vice president said he is still willing to engage in ongoing peace talks to resolve the conflict.
In an interview with VOA in Nairobi on Wednesday, Machar said Mr. Kiir's mandate should end at midnight when the country's 2011 transitional constitution is set to expire. He called on the president to resign to make way for a new government.
We want people to know that the regime in Juba is illegitimate, and therefore dealing with that regime is just like dealing with a regime that has made a coup. And practically has made a coup against the people. He has usurped the power of the people to deny them the right to elect their leaders.
A political fallout between the two leaders spiraled into inter-ethnic violence in December 2013 that has left tens of thousands of people dead. The two sides have been engaged in slow-going peace talks under the mediation of the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, but have made little headway towards a lasting deal. Machar said he is optimistic progress may be made with a new iteration of the group called IGAD Plus, which includes the African Union, the United States, and other major international actors.
We're waiting for the IGAD Plus to sit and show us the roadmap. The roadmap of how the peace process is going to continue.
Machar spoke to VOA after a news conference where he said that if Mr. Kiir will not give up power, South Sudan's people have the right to topple his regime. Government officials have accused Machar and his supporters of stalling on a peace deal. The United Nations has accused both sides of committing human rights violations during the conflict, including the forced recruitment of child soldiers. Fighting has also pushed communities to the brink of famine and displaced more than 1.5 million people within the country. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Lenny. Well, conflict continues to stifle South Sudan's oil sector. Asset holders have reduced their investments and potential investors are holding back due to instability. The global research and consulting firm Global Data reports oil production in South Sudan was approximately 240,000 barrels per day at the end of 2013. It is believed to have fallen to around 165,000 barrels per day in 2014. Matthew Jarecki is the head of oil and gas research at Global Data. He says neither South Sudan's government nor rebel forces are in full control of key oil locations, and he tells me it's a factor that is negatively impacting the country's oil industry.
Prior to the conflict, the country was producing around 250,000 barrels per day, and ported production since the conflict began for the first half of 2015 has been around 160,000 barrels per day, which is mainly due to a shutdown of fields in the Unity State, which occurred when the operator ONGC Videsh, part of Indian National Oil Company, pulled out at the beginning of 2014, shortly after the conflict began. Going forward, production is expected to continue to fall through the second half of 2015 as CNPC and Petronas, both operators in the region, have also withdrawn their foreign staff.
What does this mean, then, economically for the country?
Well, South Sudan is one of the countries with the highest dependence on oil revenues, where it makes up over 90% of the government budget. So falling production doesn't bode well. for the government, especially with a conflict requiring the funding to support the military and, of course, the people of Sudan who are almost completely reliant on foreign aid at that point.
Apparently, this conflict is really impacting trade and investment. Do you see this continuing in this cycle?
Absolutely. International companies are very reluctant to invest in South Sudan due to the conflict and threat of potential sanctions based on the actions of the government and the rebels. You know, for example, ExxonMobil has already pulled out of an exploration agreement, and Total, who had intended to conduct exploration, has put that on hold. And, you know, the current operators who had existing relationships and operations in the country have pulled back from their investments in the country.
Also, how is South Sudan's dependence on Sudan's pipelines affecting the country's oil growth?
It has a major impact, as the agreement was set during a higher oil price environment as a flat fee. So since the oil price has fallen, South Sudan's revenue on a per barrel basis has plummeted. It no longer is conducive to profitable operations for them. They're also vulnerable to Sudan being their only export route, and that, of course, could expose them further. But then again, Sudan relies on those revenues just as much or almost as much as South Sudan relies on the oil production revenues.
Given all of these negative factors affecting South Sudan's oil industry, what is the future of the country's oil industry?
South Sudan has significant existing infrastructure and large reserves, but it doesn't have the local expertise to capitalize and monetize these natural resources. However, without political stability, IOCs aren't going to be willing to invest. And unfortunately, the situation will have to work itself out before there's a return to a constructive industry.
Matthew Jarecki is head of oil and gas research at Global Data. He spoke with me from New York City.
Eritrean ambassador Tesfa Mikael Garatu says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality. The Eritrean diplomat also has told Reuters news agency that the high numbers of Eritrean migrants reaching Europe this year are the result of human traffickers, not alleged human rights abuses by his government. Tesfa Mikael is the former Eritrean ambassador to the United Kingdom. The UN Refugee Agency recently reported that each month an estimated 5,000 Eritreans flee their country to avoid forced labor, torture, and other rights violations. Refugees complain that Eritrea's mandatory national service has become an open-ended sentence to forced labor for hundreds of thousands of its citizens. Many European countries have created liberal asylum policies for Eritreans based on alleged human rights abuses by the government in Asmara. Tesfa Mikael tried to persuade the UN Rights Council to terminate the work of investigators who produced the 484-page report accusing Eritrea of widespread torture, forced labor, and other human rights violations. Last week, however, the Council renewed the investigation, which could lead to referring Eritrea's leader to the International Criminal Court for Crimes Against Humanity.
A panel of experts released its assessment yesterday on the World Health Organization's response to the West Africa Ebola outbreak. It said the crisis not only exposed organizational failings in the WHO, but shortcomings in the 10-year-old international health regulations. The panel's chair called the outbreak a defining moment. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Former Oxfam Great Britain executive director Dame Barbara Stocking unveiled the findings of the Ebola Interim Assessment Panel.
I think you all know that a year back from now, we were really looking into the abyss, wondering how we could make sure that Ebola did not spread to the whole world.
She explained why the scale of the disease was a defining moment for the WHO and member states.
We think that there is a need for reform in the international health regulations. There is a need already for adherence to the regulations that are there, but we think they need strengthening, in part because there are few incentives for countries to declare emergencies, but also a number of countries do, in emergencies, including this one, put on trade and travel bans, which not only frighten people out of declaring, but they also make it very difficult to deliver a proper response.
The panel examined the WHO as a health emergency agency.
We know that for it to function properly for that, it will need to be changed quite a lot to be truly fit for purpose. But we think that is perfectly possible, and we are very pleased to know that the World Health Assembly agreed with us.
The panel also considered the WHO's role and cooperation with other health and humanitarian systems.
The WHO needs to make sure that it is properly interconnected with that wider humanitarian system, because we believe that if that had happened back in May, June of last year, we wouldn't have reached the position that we did.
The expert said WHO member states must also do their part, including political and financial support to the organization. The Ebola Interim Assessment Panel said while health is considered the sovereign responsibility of countries, the means to fulfill this responsibility are increasingly global. It recommended that countries should be given incentives to encourage them to notify public health risks to the WHO. It also said global health issues should be at the center of the global security agenda. It added that the World Health Organization should remain the lead agency in an emergency response, but it stressed that organizational and financial issues must be urgently addressed. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. And an Eritrean ambassador says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has announced a $2.1 billion bailout of as many as 18 states that have not been able to pay their workers for more than 2 months. 2 months after his election, Mr. Buhari says states facing major financial crises would receive funds from dividends of the Natural Gas Agency and through soft loans from the central bank. Many governments of the nation's 35 states have been plagued by corruption, another crisis Mr. Buhari has promised to tackle.
In other Nigerian news, a coroner in Lagos says the preacher whose church dormitory collapsed, killing 119 last September, is criminally negligent and should be prosecuted. The coroner's report blames evangelist T.B. Joshua of the Synagogue Church of All Nations for construction of added floors to the guest house without getting building permits. 81 of the dead were from South Africa.
And media reports and eyewitnesses in northern Cameroon say at least 13 people have been killed in an attack by Boko Haram fighters on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde. Government officials say at least 3 attackers were also killed in the fighting.
Cameroon Communication Minister Issa Chiruma Bakari says Boko Haram fighters attacked the village of Bordo on the border with Nigeria's Borno State early Tuesday, and that the fierce fighting lasted about 5 hours. He says the bodies of 3 suspected Boko Haram fighters were found on Cameroonian territory but that the attackers escaped to Nigeria with the bodies of several more fighters killed in the battle.
As it is, we do not have all the facts on the exact circumstances of this attack. Nevertheless, we can indicate that our defense and security forces vigorously retaliated against this barbarous attack and forced thereby the attackers to retreat.
Chiruma said Cameroon's military seized a large quantity of weapons from the attackers and destroyed their vehicles. He assured Cameroonians the military will secure the border region.
Allow me to restate to our population and the international community the relentless commitment to defend the territorial integrity of Cameroon and to protect all women and men as well as their properties.
It was the second armed attack on Cameroon since the Nigerian extremist group went on the run in early February this year following a Chad, Cameroon and Nigeria joint military offensive against the terrorists. On March 3, Boko Haram militants took revenge on civilians in northern Cameroon, burning schools to death and raising mosques and churches. The militants group, which has aligned itself with the radical Islamic State group in the Middle East, seeks the establishment of an Islamic State in Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Tunisian Prime Minister Habib Issid says his country is starting to build a wall of sand and a moat along the border with neighboring Libya. The goal is to stop terrorists from infiltrating Tunisian territory. The Tunisian government has been taking preventative measures to prevent a repeat of the terror attack, which left 38 tourists dead on June 26th. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The terrorists who trained in Libya and gunned down 38 tourists on a beach last month has forced the Tunisian government to take action to prevent further attacks from taking place and assure skittish tourists that Tunisia is safe. Prime Minister Habib Assaid. Speaking Wednesday on state TV, Assaid says the Tunisian army will build a 160-kilometer-long wall along the length of the country's border with Libya, with a moat next to it. The prime minister indicated that the wall would be made of sand and would be finished by the end of the year. He said security cameras and surveillance posts would be placed at regular intervals. Assaid added that the recent decision to impose a state of emergency was prompted by fears that outside plotters were acting to carry out further acts of terrorism and mass killings to destabilize and demoralize the country. Tunisian gunman Saif Eddine Rezgi reportedly trained with Islamic militants in Libya before carrying out the bloody June 26 attack at the Imperial Marhaba Hotel in the resort town of Sousse. Tunisian officials have said the drop in tourism resulting from the attack will cost the country nearly $500 million this year alone. Egypt is facing similar troubles after a series of high-profile attacks inside that country. Khattar Abu Diab of the University of Paris tells VOA that he doesn't think that building a wall is going to be sufficient to solve Tunisia's security problems and that the measure could have adverse effects as well. He says that given the existence of terrorism sanctuaries in various places, many think they can protect their security by building barriers, as Israel did with the Palestinian territories, or Europe is trying to do in the Mediterranean. But he argues such preventive measures will be difficult to enforce given the length of the borders involved and lengthy shared coastlines. Abu Diab also stresses that Tunisia and Libya do a great deal of black market trading along the border and that building a wall could adversely affect the economy of both countries. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The World Health Organization is calling for governments to raise taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products. A new WHO report presents strong evidence that increasing taxes is one of the best ways to help curb the global tobacco epidemic. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says raising taxes on tobacco makes the products less affordable. It says this is one of the most effective, low-cost ways to stop people from smoking. It notes this measure has the added benefit of boosting the tax revenues of national coffers. WHO Department for the Prevention of Noncommunicable Diseases Director Douglas Betcher considers this a win-win policy.
Some economists early this year in a Copenhagen consensus referred to it as a phenomenal Best Buy. Not only a Best Buy, phenomenal Best Buy, because it is the most cost-effective measure to reduce the consumption and prevalence of tobacco and therefore to save lives.
Betcher says evidence from countries such as China and France shows higher prices on tobacco products led to declines in smoking prevalence and tobacco-related deaths from illnesses such as lung cancer. Data from Turkey, a middle-income country, finds a 13% reduction in smoking prevalence between 2009 and 2014, following a 50% increase in tobacco taxes. Despite such progress, the WHO reports taxation is the least implemented tobacco control measure around the world. It says only 33 countries impose taxes of more than 75% of the retail price of a packet of cigarettes. Betcher blames this on what he calls devious tactics by the tobacco industry.
The most common myth that tobacco industry promotes is that increase in tobacco taxation will lead to an increase in illicit trade in tobacco products. This has been disproven. Furthermore, illicit trade in tobacco products itself ought to be tackled. Illicit trade fuels corruption and circulation of other illicit products, as well as reducing revenue for governments.
The World Health Organization reports around 6 million people, most in developing countries, die prematurely from tobacco-related illnesses each year. This is more than all deaths from HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. The UN Health Agency predicts the number of tobacco-linked deaths will rise to more than 8 million people a year by 2030 unless strong measures are taken to control the epidemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.